Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hello and welcome to Humans of Speedway. I'm Ian Brannan, and as the sport of Speedway marks its 100th anniversary, in this episode, we speak to one of the greatest riders of all time, Hans Nielsen. Through the 80s and early 90s, Denmark dominated world speedway. Hans Nielsen was known as the Main Dane. He secured four individual world championships. In total, though, through his career, he was involved in 22 world titles with Denmark. In British speedway, he topped the averages every year between 83 and 90. You could argue he's the greatest rider of all time.
The most important, I think, looking back, is to win that first world title.
Nielsen leads it, and now the crowd surely will carry him home.
I've done it, you know, I've proved that I can be the best in the world, and to then win another three obviously is great, but I think when you look back, whether I won one, two, three, the most important is that you go and win once.
We'll hear about those four world championships and examine if it could have been more as well. He finished second on six occasions over his career. We'll get the inside story on that feud with Olli Olsen and how he was conscious not to make the same mistakes when he himself became Danish team manager. And we look to what's next as Hans Nielsen takes charge of Polish club Piwa. The sport of speedway then celebrating 100 years, and across that century there have been few better than our guest in this episode. One of the greatest of all time, certainly through the 80s and the 90s, he is Hans Nielsen. Welcome to Humans of Speedway, Hans.
Thank you, pleasure.
When I look down your career, I wonder where to start, because there's so much to talk about, so much that you've done and won, of course, and we'll try and cover as much as we can over the next hour, but we'll start at the beginning, as we always do. How did speedway come into your life?
Well, I was a part of the first 50cc riders at the time, back in 73 when I started, and obviously that was a couple of years after Olli won his first world title in 71, so speedway just sort of became more known, and was so much because of that. It was more because of one of my older brother's friend. The two they're riding in a nearby club, Aalborg, sort of half an hour's drive away. I went a couple of times just to watch my brother kill ride, and didn't think too much about it. It was okay, but then his friend then started the club in Brose, where I come from, and only a couple of kilometers from where I live, starting off with the small track, which was new then. I think it was only probably one or two tracks around the country that started the year before. Silkeborg was one of them. And then we started in Brose. So I thought, well, we'll have a go. I had an old moped I was riding in the old gravel pit close by, and thought, well, we'll have a go on speedway and see what it's like. And I got hooked straight away, and my other brother also started on the 50cc, so we were riding together. There was about five of us there just having fun and messing around, and the first year, and it went off from there, and got a bit more organized the following year, got a sort of more like a proper built speedway bike on a 50cc, still Yamaha, and So I did okay a couple of years, actually 3 years on the 50cc. I won a couple of meetings, but nothing big. I did right in the championship, but never really won it. Tommy Knutsen actually won one of them. And so it was okay, but I didn't really have the best equipment. I didn't really have the money to buy all the, you know, the Chryslers was the big ones at the time. And but it was a good learning experience. Learned to slide the bike a bit, and although it was only 50cc at the time, now it's 85cc. The track was smaller than the first track. There was only like 130 meters, whereas the ones we're using now is 200 meters. So that's why they went one step up to use the 85cc's to get a bit more power to get the broadside going. So, but even then, as I say, 50cc was okay on the 130 meters. Still got it sliding a bit and got the feel of it and I got hooked on it. And so it's really, you know, after that, it was the next step was when I turned 16 was to go into the 500s.
And that process and the way you learn obviously paid dividends, because you look at the domination of Denmark through that era, and whether it was the gating or the racing skill, the craft, whatever it was, that stuff that you'd probably learn as a youngster with those names that you mentioned that you were, you know, coming through with, growing up with, you know, nobody could hold a candle to the Danish team then. So that starts with that youth development, though. So it was obviously a system that worked well.
Absolutely. And, you know, quite soon, you know, after the first year I started, I think there's probably another 8 or 10 clubs starting around the country. And certainly, yes, just starting early, turning left, and, you know, compared to other guys around the world, probably, you know, started 15, 18, 20 years old. So obviously we did have a big advantage at the time. But also, obviously, growing up in that environment, you know, with the speedway, just, you know, got hooked on it and the friendship and stuff. So yes, certainly, I think by the time we came to England, we had certainly an advantage on a lot of the other guys, and the fact that we, it was like a group of us doing really well together, and of course wanted to be the best Dane along the way as well, if possible. So that got things going as well. But of course, the little, you know, the last many years, all the countries has caught up and also have the either 85 or 125 four stroke or 140 whatever now, you know, 190 as well in this GP4. So I guess they squared up to us now, and Australia's been running it for many years, and they've obviously produced many talents there as well. So yes, but at least we got the jump at the time.
So you mentioned there, it was only 16 when you got on a 500cc bike, 17 years old, though, so not long, you make the move over to the UK. Big decision for someone to come over to a strange country. And on top of that as well, you ride at Wolverhampton. Now, talking about the length of tracks you were learning on, did you find that Wolverhampton, being a fairly tight, people call it a technical track, did you find that was something fairly easy to master fairly easily, or was it something you had to learn something different when you came here?
Well, obviously the first year I rode in Denmark, that we did ride in the league, but it was like the Danish third division, the lowest of the lowest. We had to start somewhere, you know, with the club just having started in Brost. And the tracks then was very much made up of, you know, this white chalk kind of thing. And there wasn't a bit of black shale and stuff as well. And there wasn't that much grip on it. The size was actually similar to the Wolverhampton. Wolverhampton was slightly smaller, but ours was about 300 meters, most of them anyway. So the size wasn't so much so different, but it was more that the grip, you know, the dirt, the English shale with the clay in, was really, really grippy, and a lot more of it. So when I first came over, and, you know, after having ridden 1 year on these slick tracks in Denmark and having done quite well for my club, as I say, that was third division. So I was coming from the lowest of the lowest in Denmark to the best division in England. Obviously, at the time, we weren't allowed to ride in the second best division, so we had to go straight into the top league. So that was a huge difference. So when I first came over in March, you know, we're just with the one bike, with the four valve Wisleg I just had the year before, and towards the end of the year, in my first year when I was 16, I actually won the junior championship on it. Brought that over to England, and the first run I had the practice at Wolverhampton was a bit of a shock. You know, I couldn't really turn it properly. So it took a while to get used to the tracks, but. And of course, the first meeting I rode in Wolverhampton, I didn't score. I just wasn't anywhere near it. But luckily, in the next meeting was at Craigley, and it was a bit bigger, and I, you know, got on okay, got about 6 or 7 points or something. And from then on, I adapted quite quickly, and I learned quite quickly. As I say, just 1 year on the 500cc the year before was not really much to come and race against the best guys in the world.
And it was quite a quick rise, really, and you spent a few years at Wolverhampton, but then you're getting onto the world scene, you're riding in the European under-21 final, you got into the World Pairs with Ollie Olsen, of course, who was the first world champion from Denmark as well, and all the focus was on him. And all of a sudden you go from, you know, someone who's an inspiration to riding alongside that person as well.
Yeah, it was, as I say, it was a shock to come over and line up next to Ivan Mady and Ollie Olsen and so on. And obviously to know that he had no chance of beating them, but after a couple of years, you know, got in there and mixed with them. As you say, actually we've had the World Team Cup in 78, 2 years later, or the following year in Landshut, where we're now back in the Grand Prix again, where we won for the first time. That was the first time we qualified, Denmark qualified for the World Team Cup, and then to go down there and win it and being top scorer for me, just dropping 1 point, was my big breakthrough internationally as well.
Simmons leads, the red helmet there, Peter Collins is second. Hans Nielsen of Denmark with the blue helmet, he's third, and Michael Lee is at the back.
And of course, as you say, in the following year, in 1979, we won the best pairs in Voyns, home ground, also for the first time, and together with Olle, who obviously had been a big inspiration to me, the fact that he's been been the best in the world. And, you know, when you're a little kid trying to learn to ride speedway, you look at these guys like Ivan Mady and Olle Olsen and try to copy them a little bit, and that's where you sort of, get your style and stuff from. And then to actually come and go over there and compete against them was a really big thing.
Looking at British Speedway at that time, then obviously now the focus is all on Poland and maybe Sweden, and we'll talk about that a bit more in a sec. But was Great Britain the place that you had to be if you were a serious rider? Because, like, for example, Eric Gunderson, he came over a little after that, didn't he? And ended up at Cradley. But was riding in Britain sort of a key thing that you had to do if you want to get anywhere?
Yeah, absolutely. That was the only place that was really regular racing, professional racing, and obviously all the top guys was there. So if you want to become better, you had to race against the best, and that was in England. So, and to come over and to become a full time professional speedway rider was really quite something, and to actually to be able to live of the speedway, although obviously the money wasn't all that good the first year I came over. But even so, they took good care of me at Wolverhampton, find me a nice family to stay with, and the team manager take me around. And I was riding with Finn Thompson at the time as well, helped out a little bit with travel and stuff as well. So obviously it was tough financially as well, but, you know, I made my way and it was okay. So having had a pretty good first season in 77 with about 7.5 point average for the first year.
Not a bad start.
Yeah, it was a good start. So I was able to do an okay contract for the following year and got going and got some more bikes and car and stuff and really got on the road.
I think on the whole, probably at that time, the Danes were ahead professionally, if you know what I mean. And the way that certainly my vague recollections, certainly through the 80s, that always had really good vans, great branding, you know, well presented, everything was gleaming. The Danes always seemed on it, you know, the mentally prepared, physically prepared, machines were prepared. And maybe some riders, British based riders, perhaps a little bit looser around the edges there and living a bit more of a rock star lifestyle at times.
Yeah, I think the big difference also was the fact that we made a big decision coming to England to try to be a professional speedway rider. So obviously we had to give it everything to be able to succeed, because if we didn't succeed, we would just be sent back with the next ferry. So we had to really push everything hard and to be serious about it all. Otherwise, we wouldn't make it. So I think that was a big difference as well, and that's where the British has, you know, maybe come a little lazy, if you like, a little easier, stay at home with the family and you know, have a good time. I think that was one of the big differences.
In this early stage, when you're getting into speedway, what was your expectation or hope of how your career would pan out? Were you always feeling that, you know, world championship and international level speedway was going to be your thing, or were you just there for the ride and just to see where it turned out?
Well, obviously, when I first started, I didn't expect anything. It was just fun. I never thought about even being a professional speedway rider when I first started. And the first 3 years as riding on the 50cc, all fun. It was pretty good, okay, but it wasn't really till later. I mean, when I then moved up onto the 500cc, I was sort of, I guess, still cruising, having fun, learning to ride a speedway bike, and I just happened to qualify, just scraping through to the semi-final into the Danish junior final, and happened to do well, partly because my hometown scraped some money together. They chipped in a bit of money. All the inhabitants in Brose was giving a bit of money to this new engine, and everybody was riding 2-valve Jawas at the time, all the juniors, and the Westlake had just come out a year or two before, riding it in England, and then I actually got this new engine before the final, and they just went and whipped everybody, won it with 15-point max, and then I sort of realized, okay, I'm pretty good, but it wasn't really till the final. The following winter that Finn Thompson rang me from on behalf of Wolverhampton. He was living still in Denmark in the winter, Finn, and rang me down from Aarhus and asked me to come over and ride professionally for Wolverhampton, and that was a bit of a shock. I hadn't really thought about it at all to become a professional speedway rider at the time. I was, as I say, I was just cruising and having a bit of fun and enjoying racing. So that really made me think, and obviously still being at school, I had some important decisions to make together with my parents and brothers, and obviously my parents weren't too keen for me to leave school. I only had sort of a few months left of my exam, so have to go to England in March was not too popular, but you know, in the end I convinced my parents that is what I wanted, and that's what I should do. But even so, I didn't really expect anything. I thought, yeah, it's great, I can go and ride professionally and try and make a living out of it, but never really sort of thought about world champion and stuff like that at all. I just, you know, took one step at a time, had no idea really how good I was before. I think maybe sort of during the middle of the season-ish in Wolverhampton, when I became sort of okay, started scoring 7, 8, 9 points sometimes, and I remember actually, I think a headline in the Speedway Star mentioned that you know, maybe we have a future world champion here. That I think that made me think a little bit, maybe, you know, maybe someday, and so I started slowly thinking about it from there on, I think.
Yeah, and the rest is history. What would you say was your secret? What was it in your locker that made you better than all of the other riders that you faced? Was it the fact that you could gate? Was it the fact that you always had better equipment, or you did more research into the science of speedway, or you had a riding style? What was it? What was the difference over everyone else?
Well, it's funny, you know, so many years after, I've sort of been watching I've had some old, you know, this 6mm film that was taken when I was riding the Danish Championship as a 16-year-old. And actually, when you see some of the style then already, that's been sort of following me all the way through. And I think my style was sort of based on sort of watching some of the good guys, as I said, Ola, Major, and so on. And luckily had developed a good style, you know, safe style, and a style that I could trust, and I could ride wherever I wanted to, mainly on the track. And even though it took a little while the first year when I came to England just to adapt, I adopted with that style pretty quickly to the difficult tracks in England. And that has been a big help all the way through my career, that I've been sort of pretty much control of the bike and could do, like you say, most things, go wide, inside, whatever, turn on a pinpoint and so on, and still stay on the bike for laps. That helped. So yes, and at the beginning I wasn't that a good starter, but I worked hard on it and always obviously knew it was important, and I always worked really hard on becoming a good starter. So slowly I became better and better and did okay. But funny enough, when I I saw one of them videos that was made up of all the a lot of heats when I didn't make the starts, and I didn't actually make the start all the time, obviously. So one of my things was as well to be able to pass people and as you say, go different lines, either really wide or really a lot inside or the line stuff like that. And I thought that was most fun of riding in speedway ride, that was actually passing people. But of course, you wanted to make the gate if you possibly could, less dangerous and earn more money and you win more things if you make the start. So luckily, I've got pretty far with that.
You have four world titles. Myself, looking back through your record in advance of this interview, it strikes me that it could have been a lot more. That when you consider how close you came in the likes of, 1984, 1985, and so on, that it was between you and Eric, of course, and you dominated that entire, sort of two-thirds of the 80s. It was you or Eric that there was the world champion. So that was a rivalry there as well, a friendly one, I'm sure. Maybe not always, but that for me, for you, I don't know. Do you feel that you should have had more than the four?
Well, obviously, like you say, when you look throughout the career with six seconds, wise world champion, whatever you call it. You think that, I could have maybe a little bit more luck to win two or three of them. Obviously, sometimes you got luck, sometimes you haven't. And I feel that I was close enough that I probably should have won on two or three, but, for various reasons, I didn't. For instance, a broken leg and being out for, broken foot and being out for 3 weeks up to the world final in 94 in Edwards, and being beaten by Tony in the runoff, being excluded twice in there, but still was 11 or 12 points from the other four races. And so things like that, and silly things has happened, but then other, times you had a bit of luck as well. So in one respect, it evens itself out. But I think, six second places was one or two or three too many.
People will always talk about individual world titles when they're looking at who is the greatest speedway rider of all time. And of course, you've got Tony Rickardson and Ivan Major up there. But you've talked about the ones that you missed out on. But I think speedway, though, more than an individual event, is a team event in so many places. And when you take into account World Team Cups and pairs tournaments and all these, you've actually won 22 world championships in speedway, which is way ahead of any other rider. Arguably, you could say you are the most successful speedway rider of all time when you weigh those in. Where do you feel you sit in the history of speedway?
Yeah, there's many ways to look at it. Of course, I needed help to be able to win World Team Cups and pairs as well. It's not all on my own, but of course, I've been a big contributor. But I think, all around, if you look at my career, I've always tried to be the best, whatever, whether league or individual meetings. And in the old days, there was a lot more individual meetings about, and I won a lot of them throughout my career, probably most than most riders. So in that respect, I've had obviously a really good run from, as I say, right back in, start winning things, big things, but right back in 79 and winning things all the way through my career and kept on a reasonable standard all the way through. And I think certainly, obviously, when I look back and whether, if we had the Grand Prix a lot earlier, I think I could probably have won more. But as I say, maybe the majors and Olsen would say the same thing. So, but certainly, obviously, that is where the likes of Tony Rickardson had a bit of an advantage in his later career, being able to win more that way, because he was also very, very much on top all through the year. So I think I could have won more. Maybe three of those silver medals would have been turned around to gold if it was Grand Prix throughout the years, because I felt that was. I was pretty steady all the way through the season and winning lots of things and could have won more if it was Grand Prix, I think. But as I say, others would probably claim the same. But certainly I feel very happy about not just, everything I won, but the whole career has been incredible. Been around the world and, Australia, America, and every Poland and stuff and having a great time meeting lots of people and getting friends across the world. being able to do it without too many injuries, you know, has been a big thing as well, obviously, especially now when you look at some of the serious injuries that guys have had. And then I've been very fortunate to only had a couple of broken bones and only small ones, collarbone and a few broken knuckles in my foot. But otherwise, of course, had lots of crashes and blue marks and hurt here and there and the back. I heard that a couple of times, but nothing serious enough to having troubles after my career. So that's fortunate. So altogether, whether I'm being the world best or not, it's not really that important. I think the most important, looking back, is to win that first world title. And obviously the first one in 86 was really a breakthrough for me. And that was really when I thought, I've done it. You know, I've proved that I can be the best in the world. And to then win another three, obviously, is great. But I think when you look back, whether I won one, two, three, four, seven, that's not the most important. The most important is that you go and win once, so you actually proven that you've been the best in the world.
And looking back on that, you had two very near misses in the years prior to winning your first title in 84 and 1985. And I was actually there in 1985. It's a very vague memory, but you were at Bradford, and you were on great form that year. You know, in 1985, you had won the Danish final. You got a 15-point maximum, and really, you know, it was down to you and Erik Gundersen once again. And you just had that one heat, really, where you came unstuck, and that really cost you, didn't it? When you hit the fence hard there at Bradford.
Yeah, I crashed fairly hard in that old metal fence or whatever it was. It felt like metal when I hit it, and then I couldn't use my bike again, so I had to use a spare bike. I'm sure that had some part of it.
Blowing the wind and away they go, and up to the first corner, Nielsen certainly got away with them, and he's got a nudge there. He got a nudge from John Cook, and down he is gone, and we have melodrama here. That's also because it was Cook who came across, and Nielsen is down, and he looks to be in some trouble. Well, let's look at it again. And Nielsen, you see, looks to have got a clear start. But who hit him out of the night air? It was Cook who comes across, and they all pile in together, and it's Nielsen who goes down. Again was first Ben Bunching, and we should have all four riders back in, but they're calling for a stretcher.
There's a reason most times when you don't win, and whether it's bad luck or whether it's just bad riding, whatever. But you know, I felt a little bit bad luck in some of those that I didn't win, but on the other hand, others would probably say the same.
Well, of course, you still can be champion. We ought to stress that without a runoff, but everyone's wondering whether there'll be a runoff. Are you going to look back at Heat 16 and wonder whether you could have done better and whether you were distracted by the spill before the rerun?
Well, no doubt about it, yes, I will look back, but if I can win it still, you know, I'll probably forget about it.
Yeah, I think the major fact that I didn't win it on the day and that had to go to that runoff where I was on the second bike. But it's, as I say, you need, everything needs to go your way on the day, and it didn't, you know, on the day. So, but obviously the worst part of it was, you know, second in a row that Erik won the year before as well in Gothenburg. So it was tough taking it, you know, 2 years in a row being second, especially to your rival, you know, your countryman.
So two second places in the world, and a lot of people will be very happy with that. But of course, you've seen how close you came to winning a world title, so third time lucky. And you and Erik once again do battle in Katowice in Poland behind the then Iron Curtain. Travelling to Poland at that time, obviously a very different prospect than what it is now, and a different place to go for Speedway as well than what it is now. Did you feel more pressure in any way going into that one?
Well, obviously being The third time out, you know, after being second twice, you know, I was pretty desperate. I wanted to win it real bad. And when I did, obviously, that was such a relief. And I was so, obviously, so glad and proud and to be world champion, to prove that I can do it. Because obviously, there had been a lot of talk, you know, Hans Nielsen is the only going to be the, you know, forever number two. So to actually prove to everybody that I have actually got it, I can win world titles was great, and the fact, of course, that is, you know, over the those few years, that was, you know, all you wanted to do was obviously, yeah, sure, you want to be good in leagues and open leagues and stuff, but winning that world title is really the most important thing in the world.
You finally got there, but 1986, the meeting, talk us through what you remember of it, because as with all world finals, there were twists and turns, and it went right down to the very last heat for you to confirm the world title in heat 20, I think it was, wasn't it? But there were also one or two controversial incidents, again, that could have gone either way. This time, though, you got the look.
Obviously, through the meeting, there was a lot of pressure. Eric beat me in the first one, and I had a close one with Tommy where, you know, one of us was going to go out when we crashed, and he could just as easily been me as him. So there was a lot of pressure and a lot of desperation to win it, and obviously it was a tough race, and that's, you know, what you got to do when you want to win world championship. You have to be pretty tough, and you got to do what you have to do.
Knutsen leads them around the first turn. Nielsen pegged back to second position. Now, what can Nielsen make of this as they go into the bends around the pits turn there? Knutsen leads it centre track, and coming through on the inside is Nielsen, but down goes Knutsen, and just clipping the bike there was Castagna. And the Italian there in all sorts of problems. Seems as if he clipped Knutsen's bike after the Danish rider fell. And Sean, we've got real drama here now, and we wonder what the referee is going to make of all that. And we can see it again here in slow motion.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, as it looked, Tommy just left a little room for Hans, obviously not purposely, and it seems Hans took advantage of it and just picked up a little bit. But in saying that, he seems just to come out a little bit too much to block Tommy and wasn't ahead of him enough to not have this happen. And taking Tommy down, I believe it would have to be Hans' fault. I don't know what the referee is going to do, but after seeing that again, it's hard to say what's going to happen. I would have to favor Tommy for being back in the rear end with the exclusion of Hans Nielsen, but we'll have to see what the referee says.
And obviously there's been various opinion about that race with Tommy, with me coming under him and him turning a little bit back, and we crashed and stuff. And like, when you look at the regulation, the rule book as it was in those days, it's probably the same rules now, but I think they interpreted the rules a little different then. That was more like, if you're in front, you know, you could do whatever you like almost. Whereas today, yeah, they will look more at who runs into who, and was this today, I might have been excluded instead of Tommy, but you know, at the time I was sort of ahead when we touched, and the referee rightly, after my opinion, excluded Tommy. So, but as I said, today it probably would have been different. And that's what I mean. Some you're lucky, some you're not. And this one, I was probably lucky.
I think I probably rode a bit hard, and also with Ivan Major helping me, he was saying that in world finals you've got to sort of ride 25% harder than in normal meetings. So, yes, I rode hard.
So you had the luck on your side this time, and then it came down even then to a last heat decider, and, yeah, you had to beat Jano Pedersen.
Yeah, of course, it was the last race when I only had to win the last race and beat Jano. And actually having done it, you know, obviously you've remember the moment, you know, the last lap or two, you think, Christ, you know, I hope it's not going to stop or break a chain or something.
Und hier steht es fest. Wir haben einen neuen Einzelweltmeister 1986. Und dieser heißt, und das freut uns ganz besonders, aus Dänemark, Hans Nielsen, der hier von Jano Pedersen gratuliert wird.
And when you did cross the line, it's just relief and so glad, and that you know, at last you succeeded, and you can call yourself world champion.
You said it was very important to win that first one, most important of all. How did things change for you? Did your life and career change, and did your focus change? Because you'd had this drive to go one better, you'd beaten the last couple of years. To finally then do it, then what was the aim?
I just felt that, great, I'm here. I know I can win it again if I keep going, and I want to win as many as I can. I want to win all the meetings I can. I want to do as well as I can for my clubs everywhere I ride, and I just love to be successful and enjoyed riding a speedway bike fast and making good start and passing people. I just enjoy the whole thing, and the whole thing about traveling around the world, as I say, meeting people, having acquaintances and having fun was great, and being able to make a good living at the same time was ideal.
Hey, 40, are we to see the world champion in 1987, Hans Nielsen? Tension is tremendous. A out through the first corner, and Nielsen it is who will show. Nielsen leads it. Oh, Doncaster tried to spear him and missed him. Nielsen away. Doncaster is second. Riss is third. And now the crowd surely will carry him home.
So I just wanted to go on and on and as long as I could, really. And I felt I kept a reasonable semi-standard from then on, and maybe even better the following years, and enjoyed it at the same time. So there was no time I thought, oh, I've done it. What am I going to do now? Not at all.
Four-time world champion Hans Nielsen on this episode of Humans of Speedway. So that's one world title down. There's plenty more to talk about in the next part of Humans of Speedway.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Welcome back to Humans of Speedway. Don't forget to check out some of the previous episodes. Recently, we spoke to Craig Aykroyd, FIM Speedway Grand Prix referee, Brady Kurtz, the captain of the Bellevue Aces, and also Alan Rossiter and Ben Cook as well. Incidentally, Brady Kurtz and Ben Cook involved in the Australian Speedway Championships, which are coming up in January. Find out more about what's involved there. It's an intense program of five fixtures in 10 days, traveling across Australia. All the details in the previous episodes. Right now, we're speaking to one of the greatest riders of all time, Hans Nielsen, four-time world champion, 22 world titles in all when you factor in team honours and best pairs and things like that. Hans, we've spoken about that first world title and how you finally got the better of Erik Gundersen, but you had so much other competition as well, and really the competition at the time was from fellow countrymen, Jan Andersen, Jano Pedersen, Tommy Knudsen. These were the riders you were having to beat.
Yeah, as we talked about before, we were on top of the world at the time, having, you know, three, four, five really good riders, and so obviously with we had to beat each other, and being Danes, all of us, we want to be the best Danes as well. So really kept us on our toes, and it helped us in the end. And I mean, the last few years, you've seen Poland having the same thing probably. And so certainly it's an advantage if you can be lucky enough to have a few guys on top of the world from the same country.
So when you've got these guys on the top of the world, as you say, from the same nation, from Denmark, you'd think that you would all come together and you would create a dream team, really, and sort of leave the rivalries of the individual speedway behind. But actually, the rivalries still continued when you were racing together as a team, and not least fueled by one of your heroes from your younger days, Olli Olsson, who became the team manager, and really the love was not necessarily dished out as equally as you'd like through the team.
Yeah, it's been good. And obviously at the beginning we had trouble when Olli Olsson retired and decided to become the Danish coach, team manager, where it was called at the time. And obviously with Erik and I being rivals, and he decided he was going to make Erik world champion instead of me. Obviously, there was a few problems then. So one, I think, we lost because of it in 94 in Italy when England won it. Eric and I was on top of the world and the best riders in the world at the time, so obviously we should have won it, but because we didn't really have what it took on the day, I think mainly because of a team manager tried to favor one rider, so we never really got to work properly together. Turned out that he booked us into two different hotels when we got down there, so with Eric and his camp in one and mine in another, which wasn't very very ideal. So he was just trying to, for whatever reason, to sort of put a split between us, which was pretty stupid.
A lot of people are saying that you and Eric aren't talking to each other. In fact, I saw him come up to you in the pits afterwards. I mean, what is the state of play between you two at the moment?
Well, Eric and me used to be good friends a year ago, but it seems like there's been a few problems since Olsen come in between us, but we still talk together. It's just a pity, you know. I just hope we can get an end to it, and sort of hopefully Olsen will go as team manager next year. That's really all there is to it, I think.
People would like to see an end to it, but the feud is still going on, though, isn't it?
Oh, there's still a few things going on, yeah, but at least now that I'm left out of the Danish team, at least they can't ban me now. Obviously, it's a sad situation. I mean, I would like to ride for Denmark, but it's just that I feel that I can't work with Ola. I feel he's done so many silly things that I just can't work with him.
Do you think that you and Eric will be able to patch it up eventually?
I think so, yeah. As I said before, if Ola stops as team manager, I think we'll be okay.
So the problem, as far as you're concerned, is Ollie Olsen, really, more than Eric.
Exactly.
So one went away there, so we should have won that as well. But certainly, after that, we came down, calmed down a bit, and got a bit more friendly again later when Ola was no more team manager, and we won a few, and won with others like Tommy and Jano as well, and so certainly great being on top of the world in most of the competitions in PS World Team Cup and individual as well. Those years was really great times.
Ollie Olsen will say that this is what Danes do. You know, the rivalry has always been there. Everybody wants to be the top Danes. The Danes like beating each other, and that's the same now in the Grand Prix series in this present era as it has ever been. So the rivalry's always been there. You had a big rivalry with Ollie Olsen on the track, obviously with Eric on the track, the two of you trading blows for world titles for many years. So were you expecting, when Ollie became the team manager, this rivalry to then continue in the way that it did?
No, not really. When they announced that he was going to be a team manager, probably, you know, when he retired in 83, and he was during the winter, it was mentioned that he would become a team manager. I remember actually there was a few interviews in the paper, Danish paper, and I said that no, it's fine, that's great, you know, Ola, of course. I'm sure all the stuff we've been through, obviously we were rival, Ola and I, on the track, and he's, you know, been pretty hard on me on time, so I've been pretty hard on him on time. So we were actually pretty big rivals as well. When I first started beating him in England, after I'd been there a couple of years, he wasn't obviously very, very glad that a young Dane, he came and beat him. So we became quite rivals and was pretty tough on each other. But obviously, when he then became team manager and he retired himself, I thought, okay, fine, yeah. I mean, we've been rivals, but you know, that's all forgotten now. He's going to be team manager. That's great. We can learn a lot from him, I'm sure. I'm looking forward to it, and so on. I remember saying that to the newspaper as well. But when I then realized, when we came to the first qualification, the Scandinavian final up in Sweden, obviously the first step on the way to qualifying for the World Championship, then. He was only in Eric's corner, just looking after him. And there was like two or three of us as well, all the Danes in the pits, had to look after ourselves. Then I thought, hey, what's happening here? And then it turned out later that he was he was concentrating about Eric to trying to make him a world champion, which I thought was pretty stupid when you have a team manager who's supposed to help us all. So in the end, I didn't get any help at all of him, which I had hoped for. But so you know, a couple of years went by, and I tried to get rid of him as a team manager. I thought it was very much wrong, and I did contact the Danish Motor Federation, telling them about the situation, But of course, Ola was scored at the time, and the Danish Motor Federation just didn't have any opinions at the time. So that was pretty tough couple of years.
And at this point, you're not really an up and coming rider. You're you know, finishing second in world championships, and you know, you're battling with Erik Gundersen. You're the two top riders in Danish speedway. Were you surprised that, despite your position in the sport, that your opinion really counted for not a lot?
No, it didn't really, because Ola's been there for years and had obviously worked up a lot of respect from the press and everything. So whatever he sort of said to the newspapers, you know, didn't really matter what I said. That, you know, I couldn't really sort of explain myself against him. And so everything was sort of turning his way. He had the sort of paper in his hand and told them whatever he thoughts were, and I was trying to, you know, answer in another newspaper, whatever, but obviously having Ola having the obviously the Danish crowd and paper and everything on his side and the DMU, and so it was tough for me, you know, as a sort of 23-year-old having to fight against him on my own. So obviously the rest of the team, Danish team, didn't really care too much, and so it was really only me having to fight him on my own.
Danish Speedway, though, was rocked, as was World Speedway, with the events of the 17th of September 1989.
On the very first bend, all four riders lived through their worst nightmare, an horrific crash which was to put all of them out of action for the rest of the championships. Gunnarsson came off the worst and was rushed into intensive care at a local hospital with a broken neck.
You were in the team, of course, on that day at Bradford when Erik suffered his career-ending and life-changing injuries, of course, and this is a risk of speedway. You know that when you arrive, but to see it so close to you must have sent shockwaves long beyond the day itself. You know, obviously you had to carry on with the meeting, but then over time, really, the true effects, the long-lasting effects that had, not just on Danish speedway, but on world speedway.
Yes, it certainly had. I mean, after that day, we were all just lost interest in a sense, you know, where the motivation had gone for a while, and it took, you know, weeks for us to sort of go back to normal when we, you know, eventually realized that he's going to make it and hopefully get a life again. And but, you know, it took quite a long time where we were sort of just on autopilot and did the meeting you had to do, but it was a shock to us all, definitely. I mean, we all know it can happen to anyone, and yourself included, and you just had to kind of learn to live with that. And now it got so close to you as well. It made you think a little bit, although you try to convince yourself that, you know, it's not going to happen to me, and it's a part of the sport, and so on. You know, you still obviously thought about it. So, and the fact, obviously, we lost his points as well, and as a rider as well, for the future, and well, it was tough, and especially on the night, of course, we obviously lost the motivation and all the points from Erik, so couldn't win it on the day, so England won it instead. But yeah, that was a big shock, and obviously, looking back, it's at least, you know, Erik had a, you know, he did survive and got back to a reasonable life, and has done a lot of great work for Danish Speedway as a coach for both the seniors and later the juniors.
And this incident occurred just a couple of weeks or so after you'd been crowned world champion for the third time.
But there goes Hans Nielsen to take his title, surely. The front wheel is coming up. Hans Nielsen is there to celebrate. The crowd is celebrating. The wheelie over the line sees Hans Nielsen as the world champion and joins five golden greats as men who have won this title on at least three occasions.
So you claim the final world title of the 1980s and starting a new decade, though, without Erik. Did you in some way find that you'd lost some of the edge because you didn't have the pressure from Erik in the years after that?
Probably, looking back, maybe I didn't sort of realize it probably so much at the time, but I think it took a little bit of edge of mine, desperation to win, to beat Erik, and obviously all of a sudden he wasn't there to beat anymore. And I didn't think too much about it at the time, but when I look back, I think I did lose a little bit of what we talked about, which Marslik hasn't lost yet, but that little bit of desperation and will to keep winning. I still wanted to win, but as I say, maybe not quite as desperately. So So maybe that showed a little bit after, as you say, in 90, Bradford didn't do that well. Was it when I was supposed to be third? Sean Moran got disqualified, was it? And in his history books, I think I should have been a bronze winner, but there wasn't any bronze winners. I was just number four. That was a weird thing, but never mind. But after that, yes, it took a little while. And also the GM was coming on the scene at the time, and I was still on the cotton, and starting to maybe feel that the GM was maybe just becoming a little faster than I liked, and the Gordon was maybe not developing the engine as much as I would have liked to, and didn't quite have the speed that I used to have had. So a couple of years went by, and I had to do something, and so it was like 92. I've decided that, you know, either I'm going to join the rest or I'm going to try something else. And I never really liked just to do what everybody else does. So I thought, well, I've seen the Jawa go pretty well. A few had tested the Jawa and it was going pretty well. So talked to them, went to the factory, and we've decided that we would do a works contract with them. And one of the advantages with Jawa, of course, was that they made a complete bike with frames and everything. And my longtime tuner and friend from Denmark, Fleming, we agreed that there was no reason why this engine shouldn't be able to go as fast as the GM or even faster. So we decided we would give it a chance, and we did. But obviously, it took a little while to really get it going. In 92, I then broke my collarbone and had a 3 weeks off before the Scandinavian final up in Norway, and on a rainy day. And that was the only year that I missed the world final, unfortunately. And partly maybe the Jawa wasn't quite competitive enough, and partly I had been out for 3 weeks with a broken collarbone, and so a few different reasons. And as you mentioned, Havelock was probably pretty glad that I wasn't in Russia at the time. So.
Yeah, he's got no complaints about that, I don't think.
No. So you know, I had a couple of years there, different things, as I say, with Eric not being there, and a little bit of problems with equipment and stuff. But what happened then was the following year in 93 was we'd start talking about laydowns. And actually, it was discussed at the FIM meetings in the winter 92-93, and as I say, I was there as a riders' representative, and I've talked to a few riders, and we've sort of agreed that we've seen the laydown being experimented with on the long track. Some had started using the laydown on the long track, and we're sort of thinking that, well, what happens if it gets into speedway? Do we need it, or what's the advantage and stuff? And I think we've all pretty much agreed that why would we all use laydown all of a sudden? Who's going to gain, and what's it going to do for the sport? So I mentioned this at the Congress during the winter, and brought it up about this long track thing. Should we maybe ban it now before we get it onto the speedway? Because that just, you know, if it's faster, which obviously that's why people would ride it, and if it is, then everybody would have to get on it, and then everybody would have to change their bikes and stuff, and cost a lot of money for everybody. And if it is faster, then what's the point? We don't really need the speedway to be faster. We want it to be safer, not faster. We want good racing, but faster bikes is not necessarily better racing. So I suggested it there, but the only reply from the FIM at the time was that, oh, no, we can't stop development. And I thought, what development? I mean, there's no development going a little bit faster and spending a lot of money on nothing. But that was it. So the following following year, 1993, Klaus Schlausch had made these two laydown speedway bikes, and having them tested, and they asked me to test it if I'd like to try them. And so, yeah, why not? Now they've allowed it. You know, it's going to come eventually. We're going to have to try it. And I thought it was pretty good. So I started riding his two bikes the rest of the year. And this was like maybe, well, sometime at the beginning of the year. And I think the first match I did was a test match in Denmark against England. And I thought it was doing fine. And I rode it for the rest of the year. And yeah, nearly became world champion on it in Pocking. But
yeah, another one that got away. Sam Ermolenko became world champion. But the two of you met in a real decisive heat in Pocking, and it was actually one of the most controversial incidents of that year as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, obviously, I remember one of the headlines in Speedway Star, I think they called it Pucking Hell or something like that, so, which was pretty, which it was a bit for me. But it was obviously, I felt I was on the lay down, I had the speed back, and I thought I was the fastest on the day and winning sort of most things. And obviously, when I met Sam, he made the gate, and I just had to pass him, and I was probably being too eager to pass him, and we got a little close, and it was a little bit similar to Tommy Knutsch in 86, where he was going in really wide. I just went inside him and just sort of passing him and drifting out a little bit too, and he was sort of realizing I was there and tried to turn it back on me, and we crashed.
Coming into heat 15, and this is the one the world has been waiting for, because we have the clash of the mighty. We have Sam Omalenko on the outside, unbeaten on 9 points. We have Hans Nielsen next to him in the white helmet. He has 8 points. He's been waiting a long time. And away they go, and it's Ermolenko who gets away. Ermolenko from the outside, Nielsen is after him, Smith is third. But Ermolenko has made the critical jump, and Nielsen now must set him up as they hit the bottom corner. Still Ermolenko in front, there's a bike length between them. Nielsen makes his move down the inside, going wide, 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 he's hit him. Well, what about that? Going in hard, 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 too hard. Down has gone Sam Ermolenko. We'll look at it again, but the first reaction is that Nielsen just went inside his back wheel, just collected Sam Ermolenko. Ermolenko stands clearly upset with that. It was a ruthless piece of cornering. Look at it again. Ermolenko has the line. Watch Nielsen. Nielsen comes inside. Did he pick him up? Did his back wheel make contact? You must judge for yourself, but it looks as though Sam Ermolenko has been knocked off there. Nielsen again, we'll look at it again, we'll slow it right down. Nielsen, you can see, might just be up in front, but we've seen if you have the outside line, it's beneficial here at Pocking. There is Ermolenko. Ermolenko on the outside, and Nielsen moves across there. The race has been stopped. The referee has got to exclude somebody for being the cause of the stoppage. And it looks as though Nielsen is going to be the man, because Nielsen came under just so hard that it might have just had the drop. But Ermolenko went down, and the white light is on, and Nielsen has been excluded, and we're going to be talking about that for years to come.
And unfortunately, my good old friend Frank Ebden looked at on Sam's side. I never was too much friendly with Mr. Ebden, so I think that way a little bit as well, but as I say, that you know, 86, so I was a little bit lucky maybe, and now I was a little bit unlucky, so it, you know, some you win, some you lose. But I think another problem on the day, of course, was the fact that Sam got a little lucky when he stopped in the race, was with a broken chain or whatever, and somebody else then later stopped up front, and they stopped the race, and he got back in it again. That was a big mistake, I think. And if that hadn't happened, then you know, the runoff would be for the world title instead of the silver medal against Chris at the time. So it could have been one. Yeah, again, small bits and pieces. Some you win, some you lose.
Yeah, so another silver medal, and same again the year after, runner-up to Tony Rickardson when he claimed the world title in the last ever one-off world final in 1994. And of course, after that, it was the Grand Prix Series, and the Grand Prix Series then started off fairly small. It was six rounds, but you were the first Speedway Grand Prix champion in 1995. So you said that you prefer the Grand Prix format, so you must have been delighted when this finally came in, and you showed that by winning it.
Well, obviously, when they first started talking about it, we said it off. 3 or 4 years before it actually happened, you know, first they had the Amsterdam thing over the 2 days, which was, I guess, a little bit of a test in one respect, although they realized 2 days in a row is not the really ideal thing. I thought so after I won it, but obviously. But
now we move into Heat 38, which Sam Ermolenko had to win to stand any realistic chance of winning the world title.
But certainly, while the discussion was going, I was the riders' representative in the FIM, and obviously I was supporting it, well, for myself, and a lot of other riders would like the system to go ahead as well. I thought, obviously, it would be an advantage for me as well, having been a pretty good performer all through the season. I thought it wouldn't be an advantage, and I thought it would be good for the sport having regular events, you know, so it's not only that one event you see on television every year and everybody talks about. Now you'll have an event every couple of weeks or three to talk about, and obviously If you have a world champion after six rounds, and especially now with 10 or 11, it's more realistic, or the right world champion after so many rounds. So in any way, I thought it was a good idea. And I think, you know, with sponsors, television and all sorts of things, it was great. And I was really pleased that it did come into terms in 95, and I had a chance to win it for the first time then.
And we look at the overall standing. You can see Hans Nielsen has increased his lead over Tony Rickards, and Henrik Gustafsson has moved up into third place. Then we have Mark Lamb and Billy Hamill on 41. Chris Lurie losing a bit of ground on 40. Thomas Golub on 38. Sam Ermolenko on 35. The celebrations will go on long into the night. The Danes will have their lager out.
On the subject of the Speedway Grand Prix Series now, Bartosz Smarzlik has joined you on four world championships now. It's a fairly select club. Do you think that he can go on to be the greatest ever? Do you think he will continue winning? And what do you think is the secret to Smarzlik's success in how he rides? Is it the fact that he keeps out of trouble, that he has a particular style that gives him the advantage over his competitors? And your memories of seeing Smarzlik as a youngster, when you were working in that scene with the Danish setup?
Well, I don't think there's one secret. I mean, he's been a great rider ever since I first saw him on the 21. I think I've been in Sweden for 121 World Championship team, and already then on this little track in Norrköping, it just turned it like, you know, it was play for him. And already then I thought, oh, gee, well, you got a good guy here for the future. And obviously watching him through the years, the stuff he's been doing, a really tough rider, hard rider. You think he takes some gambles, but on the other hand, he's not crashing. He knows what he's doing, and just an incredible rider. And obviously having the setup he has, his family behind him and everything, and the sponsors and the money and everything, he's on top of the world. But and then you have guys asking, well, is he going to keep winning the next 5-10 years? And every time it happened, like, you know, Ty Wolfenden did the same thing the first 3 years, and then you think he's going to win another, you know, he's going to win 7 or 8 or something. But, you know, sooner or later you, I did it myself. You're going to lose some of that desperation and will to win, and there are other things in life. You get kids and stuff, and that hasn't happened for. Well, he has got kids, yeah, Smarzlik, but he certainly hasn't lost the drive yet. But you know, sooner or later he's going to, you would think, and then others are going to take over. But whether it's going to be after 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 titles, we don't know. But I certainly hope he's going to continue to do really well, because he's a hell of a rider to watch, and I love to watch him.
And the future for Danish Speedway has been in your hands, and yours and Erik Gundersen's, to name two, bringing through this next generation, of which we're familiar with now in this country. We've had the likes of Benjamin Basso, Jonas Knudsen, a couple of the up-and-comers. Jonas has got a brother as well, hasn't he, who's also riding. And then on the Grand Prix stage, you've got Leon Madsen, Mikkel Mikkelsen, Anders Thomsen. So the production line of Danish Speedway is still strong.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously that's what I had hoped. As I said, when Ola became a Danish team manager, I had hoped the same thing, that I could sort of learn a lot from him. But as I said, it didn't happen. But obviously all these young guys these days have had Erik for many years, and myself was there for 6.5 years. So hopefully we've been able to put them on the right road. And I think we've certainly got a lot of talent there. As you say, Basso is certainly one of them. And hopefully during the next few years they'll develop, and hopefully we'll get an Danish world champion within a few years as well. But it, you know, it's a long road to success, as we know, and so we won't really know till a few years. But at least, you know, we've got the Leon Madsen, Mikkel Mikkelsen, Anders Thomsen as well being out there in the Grand Prix. So I have been, and hopefully Anders will be back in again. At least we still have Mikkel and Leon. Hopefully they'll go and win it one of these days as well.
When you were the Danish team manager, were you hyper aware of making sure that you gave attention to all of the riders there in the pits, and not to fall into the same sort of situation as you'd been on the receiving end of with Olli Olsen? So that you obviously you've got a number of Grand Prix riders there to manage. Were you able to spread your time evenly across them?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, having three Grand Prix in the series, and you have to look after them, obviously, is pretty tough, and you try and help them as much as you can, and obviously some want more help than others, so you do whatever is wanted of you, and I certainly wouldn't want to be in the situation where I just help the one and not looking after the others, so that's been a bit of a tightrope to walk.
Four-time individual world speedway champion, 22-time world champion in all various different contests, Hans Nielsen is with us on Humans of Speedway. So far, we haven't really talked about Team Speedway. We've been chatting for an hour. We'll do that in the next part of Humans of Speedway.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Currents issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Humans of Speedway. Don't forget to follow, like, or subscribe for free to this podcast so you don't miss any of the new ones as soon as they arrive. And there will be further episodes to come in this series. In this one, though, we're speaking to one of the greatest riders of all time, Hans Nielsen. He's won a total of 22 world championships. Is he arguably the most successful speedway rider of all time? Certainly is overall. And he also won quite a few titles and things with teams as well, including in the British leagues. He was a three-time British League champion, twice British League Knockout Cup winner, and a three-time British League Pairs champion. He represented the Wolverhampton Wolves, the Birmingham Brummies, the Coventry Bees, but the team that he's most synonymous with is one that's actually back at the top level of Speedway now in the UK, and that's Oxford. Of course, the Oxford Cheetahs are now at the championship level, but when Hans Nielsen was racing there, they were one of the dominant sides through the period from 1984 to 1992. So they were actually your third club, Hans. A big move, but a club, as I say, that you spent a long time with and had a lot of success with.
Yeah, I as you mentioned, I was struggling a little bit as far as winning anything with Wolverhampton and later Birmingham. So it was a great change to go to Oxford, where they really had big plans and the whole setup and the track was really good, and they had a couple of track guys there and doing the track really, really nicely, and nice grip and good racing lines, and the fact that they spent the money they had to get the riders we needed was I was really looking forward to. And obviously, once we got going, it did show. We did really well, and the team spirit there, and all the management, team managers, everything was great. And obviously, great team spirit and good crowds. You know, it had to be a success, and it was. And I really enjoyed racing, obviously, on the track, the best track I thought at the time in England, and everything about it was great. And winning those titles with Oxford was really great. So I spent 9 years there, and very enjoyable years. Good friends and everything there, and it ended. A little bit abrupt, where I would have liked to stay for my testimonial, but it was the year that they decided they were going to have a pay structure into force, which I didn't quite agree on. And the only way you could get out of it was having sponsors instead. And unfortunately, the Oxford argument was that, well, I was having a testimonial anyway, so I could make my money up there, which I didn't think was quite right. And, you know, the testimonial should be something extra. And in the end, they didn't want to find a sponsor for me either to make up for the wage. So in the end, I was sort of deciding that I would go back to Denmark, and decided that it was probably not worth racing in England if the money weren't there. So we were, you know, getting that time of your career that, you know, sooner or later you want to go back to Denmark and raise your family. But then Coventry came in, and I had 2 good years with Coventry, also a great setup and everything, and that was good. But, you know, I would have wished that I could have stayed in Oxford, you know, the rest of my career over there, and for that last couple of years or three, and had my testimonial. It would have been nice, but that wasn't to be. So that was only a little sour grape as far as Oxford was concerned.
Prior to that, and throughout that time as well, from 1983 with Birmingham, and then same with Oxford, onwards to 1990, so for 8 years on the trot, you finished at the top of the league averages, which is an incredible record, which I think still stands to this day. Clearly, whenever you were visiting a track, or whenever any side was up against a side with you in it, you knew that you were probably going to score a hatful of points. Which riders and which teams did you find, though, the most difficult to race against? Everybody hated racing against you, but who did you find gave you the sternest test?
Well, obviously, there was various areas. Obviously, when I first came over, obviously, it was the Olsen and the Majors and so on. But later on, obviously, it was like Eric. Obviously, whenever we met, you know, meeting Cradley, it was great for the crowd. And we sort of... James Eric won one race and I won another and so on. So we were very equal at the time. And of course you had Tommy Knudsen's and Jan O. Petersen. But in the earlier days, of course, I remember also, of course, Chris Morton, Peter Collins up at Bellevue, on the old Bellevue. There were some great races up there. That was incredible racing track. I was already then becoming a fairly good starter, although I didn't need to be that good to beat them at the start, because they weren't very good at the start. So most times at Bellevue, I would beat them at the start, but the track was so wide and big that you just couldn't stop them. They just passed you, and I knew it was going to happen, but it was a bit frustrating. Later on, yeah, I obviously, yeah, got a way to beat them and got a little faster, but certainly the first few years there was pretty frustrating. But so there's been, I mean, those days, they're all there, all the good guys, and you knew the top guys from each team, was, you know, whether it was Jan Andersen from Reading, or even back at, you know, Malcolm Simmons as well, and all these guys, and the Phil Crump. I used to have some great races against him at Swindon. Swindon was one of my favorite tracks at the time as well, going back, and the top guys there's a lot of top guys in all the clubs, and obviously you knew that you had to be on the best to beat these top guys, especially on their home tracks.
And now Oxford are back, and the place looks very, very similar to how it used to. And looking back on some of these, you know, videos back from the 1980s and early 90s when you were there, the place is very, very similar. And now Oxford running three teams in 2024, including one in the Premiership in Britain as well. So the top stars are heading back to Oxford once again.
Yeah, it's been great to see the development, and yeah, as I say, all the good years I've had there, and to see it back now, as best we've seen it for many years is great. And obviously you think that they belong in the best league, and obviously that would be great to see them up there. But on the other hand, if you can understand, if they have the great success with almost full house now in the crowds, you think, what's the next step? But certainly, yeah, they deserve to be in the best league, and we would love to see them there, and wish them luck.
You've had experience of riding speedway bikes from the 1970s, really through to the present day. You've been around speedway for that time. You were one of the first to race on a laydown engine, and leaving behind the days of the uprights. And I know from conversations I've had with Kelvin Tatum and Chris Louie that I know the three of you have been conversing about how to make the modern engines less volatile, because they have developed over time. The laydowns now are not the same as the laydowns you used in the 1990s. So just talk to us about that and how you feel that engines could be improved.
I probably wouldn't go back to uprights. I would change the bikes so it gets back to the sort of more riding ability and bike, easier to ride as in old days. And it's not only the fact that it's become lay down, it's more the fact that the changes with the silencer has been the biggest difference to the bike characteristics over the last I don't know how many years it's since they start messing with them. It was about 10 years or something they start messing with the silencers. First you had the one where you couldn't get the gas all the way through, and later when they realized that's no good, then now we have the 25 millimeter outlet, and it was 50 in the old days, and that reduction has just made the engine so much more sensitive, and also makes it hot, and it doesn't last so long. So it's done a lot of bad things. So the first thing I would do if I had anything to say was get the old silencer back, but with filling, because they did actually do tests when they talked about 10 years or whatever it was ago to do make this new one. They did test with the old one with the filling, actually was less noisy than the new one. And the only argument for the FIM not to approve it was that they said, well, it's in the rule book, you can't use filling. Which I thought then, I didn't have anything to do with it at the time, but I thought, oh, that sounds pretty stupid. I mean, yeah, maybe it's in the rule book, but you're the guys that makes the rules. You just change the rules and put this filling in instead, because this new filling was a new kind of stuff you use in cars as well, and that would last for years. So that would have been so much easier, and the bike would have been still been a lot easier to ride. And that is the biggest problem these days. They are so fine-tuned, and you got to be pretty lucky on the day to get it the right setup. And that's why you hear even more now about setups and stuff than you did in the old days, because now you got such a small tunnel where, you know, you got to really hit it really right. And one race you can have it right, and the next race you can be right off and got be last, and that's a shame, and that must be frustrating for the riders, and expensive, because you have to have them serviced so much more often. So that is probably the biggest thing I would change. That is the silencer. Then of course the bike would probably be quicker as well, so you probably need to slow it down a little bit again, maybe just with a smaller carburetor again, or something like we did back in the days, from I think was it 38 millimeter down to 34 as we're using now. And maybe it's time to go down another couple of millimeters, or even go down with the rev. You know, we have 13,500 is the max. You could even go down, if you got the new silencer, go down to 12, because the old silencer with the old big hole in that would have more torque, and the bike just rides so much better with torque, and you don't need so many revs. That'll make the bike last a lot longer. So things like that I would change, yeah. But going back to the uprights, obviously you would have the same problem, and the cost again. If you have to go back to the uprights, you'll have to change everything again, which would be silly, I think.
Yeah, bad news, upright fans. The laydowns are here to stay. You are heading into team management, Hans, in 2024 in the Polish second division with Piwa, which is a side you rode for six seasons. So one that you're synonymous with and had most of your success in Poland with. And some familiar names as well in that team for British listeners. Adam Ellis and Dan Jilks will be racing for you. Jonas Knudsen as well, another name who's spent time in the UK in the last couple of seasons. Jonas Jepsen of Denmark, also involved in that side as well. So a new challenge for you at familiar surroundings.
Yeah, I think they built a reasonably good team. Of course, it's difficult to exactly say how strong a team do we have to have in second division. But, you know, when you look at other teams, I think we've got a fairly good team. The big joker at the moment, I think, is the fact now they have to have two Polish juniors in there. And the two juniors we have, I don't know much about. And obviously, if we can get them going and their points count just as much as others, that could be a difference. But I think the whole... setup of the club is really good, and I went to see them before this season when they had the presentation for the riders, and they've just started up then, and I think, you know, it's been a little bit up and down the last few years, but this new management now seem to be very professional and doing a lot of hard work and doing the right things. So although it was sort of, we didn't actually discuss whether I should help them or not in the spring, but you know, I think it was in the air a little bit that maybe they would ask me one day, but they did after the season, and I thought, yeah, great, I'll look forward to it, and I think it's a great challenge. Now I've obviously had a good career myself, and now I had the coach for Denmark 6.5 years, where I learned a lot. That was a big shock from being a rider to being a Danish coach, and now I've learned a lot from that, and hopefully I can use it in to do some good work at PIWA. The biggest difference, of course, to the coach job as a Danish coach is the fact that now you have a meeting every week almost, and you have the same team, and you can, you know, keep building. And whereas, you know, the Danish coach job is just the one big meeting a year for the team. Of course, also you have others for the under 21s and under 19s and so on. But so this is more continuous, and you can sort of, you know, build up and hopefully be successful that way. And obviously I will be involved in a few different things with tracks and stuff like that as well. And so it's going to be fun, but of course a lot of traveling again, but I don't mind so much the traveling. It's as far as the Danish coach job was more, you know, all the politics and all the office work and stuff every day. After you've been traveling for 3 days and you come home and you still have a lot of work to do, this will be a little different. It's mainly when you're away and you have all the work. So a new challenge, but I look forward.
Well, surely success is not far away. It rarely is. And your career speaks for itself, Hans. And just looking at it, there's so much we could have talked about. But over 50 individual medals, over 25 team medals, 11 World Cup medals, 7 World Pairs medals, 12 Speedway World Championship podiums, in effect, including, of course, 4 gold. You've said that the first world title would be the thing that stands out most in your career, but I'm interested that beyond that, what achievements do you hold up personally in highest regard? Aside winning your first world title, what would you single out as being your big achievements?
Well, it typically, you know, the first wins you have, I mean, the Danish championship on, you know, the junior championship back as a 16-year-old, it really is very fresh in my mind. And now I've had that old 6mm film turned onto to a hard disk as well. Like, you know, being able to watch that is really fun. But of course, after that, again, the desperation before winning the first title in 86 in Horso in Katowice there was is absolute biggest for me, and the biggest in my memory. And after that, I guess it was really big when we won the first title as well. Ole and I, best pairs in Denmark, where it was really huge as well, with a full crowd, 18,000 people, and winning at home was huge. But also the year before in Landshut, winning the first time in, as I say, well, the first times are the special ones. The World Team Cup in Landshut was fantastic. And obviously, when you're after that, when you're not talking titles, you know, the farewell meetings in Brost and in PIWA I had was huge as well. Last time on a 500cc bike in PIWA in 99 when I retired, it was good with the full house there and celebration and everything. So.
And, well, you mentioned on your 500cc bike there for the final time, but it wasn't too long ago that you were on an SGP4 bike where you, well, you did some laps on the SGP4 bikes, didn't you, in Melilla, but then you also took on Leon Madsen in a race and you won. Still got it.
He was sort of, all meeting, he was saying, "Ah, Hans, I want to have a go on this 190. And so he went out before the meeting just to have a little practice and thought, "Ah, it's pretty good fun." And he was all through the meeting. He said, I want to meet you in a race, Hans. Can we do a race?" And I said, there's a lot of races going on, all this and stuff. But yeah, when we finish the last race, the final, we can have a quick go. But of course, by then, the camera had turned off. So when we had the little race, so of course he thought he was going to beat me easy because I was we probably didn't look that fast when Sam and I was racing. But I did turn it on a little bit more when I met Leon. So I beat him pretty comfortable. So he didn't like that too much.
You don't lose it, eh? Those old skills came straight back to you.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, you never lost it. Well, thanks for joining us, Hans. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. You know, an absolute icon of many people, including myself, who'll be listening to this, who will have been entertained and thrilled and maybe exasperated at times. But you have been an entertainer throughout your career and one of the all-time greats. Before we wrap up, just a word on British Speedway and how it can contribute to a rider's development. You, of course, made the decision to come over here very early. It's been very good to you, but you've been a very good rider. It hasn't really set you back, I think, coming over to Britain. Is British Speedway still a place to come to learn your craft if you want to go on to the top level?
Well, certainly, as team coach, I've been recommended the young guys to go over there. I think it's still a great place to learn. It's a great country. I love to be over there. The people over there are very friendly and all the different tracks you learn. So yes, I think it's still the place to be, certainly for, you know, when you're young. You can obviously discuss later on when you're busy, when you want to go and make money in Poland and the way you have to be to make money. And other places, maybe Sweden and in Denmark, and you might be too busy having to ride in four countries. But it's a great place to be, and we certainly recommend it to anybody to go there and ride. And nice to see some of the elite coming back, some of the Grand Prix riders coming back, and hopefully make it big again over there someday.
Yeah, it's certainly heading in the right direction. Well, look, thanks for joining us, Hans. It has been an absolute pleasure and a delight. All the best for 2024 and everything you do, and thanks for joining us on Humans of Speedway.
Thank you. You too, yeah. All the best. Bye.
Hans Nielsen on Humans of Speedway. Absolutely incredible. What you can't see, of course, by listening to this is the fact that when he was doing the interview in his office, on the wall behind him, he's got all of his medals mounted and framed. Of course, there's 22 gold medals that he won through his career for the different, you know, team events, the individual events, but also there's the silvers and the bronzes. There's a lot of metal work in there, so it was incredible to see that and just show quite how much he's won over his career. Thanks must go as well to Ryan Guest, who helped secure the interview with Hans for the podcast. There's many more episodes to listen through. In this current series, we spoke to Brady Kurtz, the title-winning captain of the Bellevue Aces, and we've also got Bellevue's new signing, Ben Cook, from a few weeks back as well. He's also the captain of the Poole Pirates. We've got Speedway Grand Prix referee Craig Aykroyd, who was also the referee on duty that day where Bartosz Smarzlik got disqualified in the Danish GP. And we spoke to Alan Rossiter earlier as well. But there's many, many more episodes to go back through over the last few years. So please do delve into those and help fill out the time through those cold, dark winter months. We'll be back with another episode very soon. In the meantime, thanks for listening once again to Humans of Speedway.
Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.